We'll start now so that we can finish on time. I'm conscious of the fact that people want to frock up for tonight's gala dinner hosted by KPMG. There will be information on a slide about buses to the convention centre, from the convention centre to the Four Points Hotel. It will depart at 5:30, which is not long after this session. This session should end at 5:15. So there's information on that. Just a reminder now, if you're thinking of going, if you come from Sydney and you're thinking of going home and visiting the family, forget it, because the KPMG gala dinner is on tonight. We're asking you to get your glad rags on and come dressed as your favourite 007 character, a night not to be missed, relaxed and stylish. It's going to be a great night with an after party, I understand, booked or planned for one of the bars around town, so I will expect you here to be sharp-eyed at 8:30 in the morning. In a remarkable piece of efficiency, all presentations from yesterday's sessions are now on the website. Tomorrow's program starts at 8:30 in the morning, sharp, and evaluation forms, just a reminder to progressively fill those out, otherwise you'll be completely mind-blank if you leave it till tomorrow, and we'd appreciate that feedback. At this session, we're going to look at, in two aspects, at the coalface. Firstly, Mark Lawrence is going to talk about risk management, and then Steve Taylor-Gooby is going to talk about global insurers, the future. The program said that Mark's topic was going to be about retail banking. That was news to him. It was really just to sucker in the retail bankers here. Let me assure you, it might make some reference to retail banking, but it's really going to be about risk management. Where to from here? Important industry lessons from the financial crisis. And I see, by the way, that the there's no doubt that the Institute is being very politically astute. Where else, what other event do you go to where there's an actual group hug between the Minister and the head of the Institute on stage for all to see and record? So things are going sterlingly. Now to Mark Lawrence, and we're going to follow the usual format. Mark's going to talk for 40 minutes or so. Won't be more than 40 minutes. Steve's going to talk for 30, and that leaves about 20 for a discussion. Mark's managing director of his own company, which specialises in global risk consultancy, based in Melbourne. He advises Australian, Asian and international financial service organisations and regulators on risk management issues, including Basel II, as we heard yesterday, market, credit, liquidity, counterparty and operational risk measurement and management, risk disclosure and transparency, and risk culture, compensation and governance. And no doubt we'll hear about some of those things this afternoon. His field of risk management, as being a thought leader in the risk management field, comes from 13 years of experience in senior roles with global financial institutions, including Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, a few stories to tell there, Societe Generale in New York. And prior to his current venture, he spent over 2 years as an expert principal at McKinsey & Company and as a member of McKinsey's global risk management practice. He still actually consults these days to McKinsey and served major institutional clients in that role throughout Australia, Asia and North America. He may be known to you in the role that he spent 5 years as a member of the management board and group chief risk officer at ANZ. So he, like many other people in this room, has training in mathematics. He has a doctorate in mathematics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he taught at the Pennsylvania State University and University of Wisconsin-Madison. Please welcome Mark Lawrence.
Thank you very much, Peter, and good afternoon, everybody. I know what a challenge it is to stay attentive and interested and excited for the last session of the day. So we'll try to make your time here well spent, and apologies for those who did come to hear about retail banking. I am a risk management specialist. My first risk management job was at Merrill Lynch in New York in the northern summer of 1987, 22 years ago. I know you're all thinking I don't look that old. I feel that old. And funnily enough, that was in response to a catastrophic loss in trading mortgage-backed securities at Merrill Lynch at the time, which was actually written up in a well-known book called Liar's Poker. So here we are, 22 years later, dealing with catastrophic losses arising from trading mortgage-backed securities. So, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The intention of my presentation this afternoon is to ask what I believe is a very fundamental and important critical question, actually. Given the outcomes and the damage done from the financial crisis, why should anybody in this room or any taxpayer or any counterparty or any depositor have confidence in the risk management in financial institutions, banks in particular? We've seen household names like UBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and on, have really quite catastrophic losses from really what are similarly catastrophic failures in their risk management capability. So where forward? How shall we move forward with risk management? It can't be the case that business as usual or more of the same is an option. That just cannot be an option. So I think all of us need to deeply inquire into and do the best job we can to understand what are the key failures that occurred in risk management and what are the lessons learned and what must we do differently moving forward if we're to restore confidence in our financial institutions. So I start with this cartoon, which I recognise a little bit perhaps difficult to see. I thought we were just buying a house. We didn't quite realise that everything else, in fact, the entire global financial system was depending upon our mortgage. What's interesting about this cartoon from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is that it actually was published in October 2007. And I think at that time, even the artist had no idea about the truth of what he's drawn there. So how should we think about the financial crisis from a risk management perspective? Here are a couple of possible perspectives. First one, risk models have failed. Now, that wouldn't be a popular perspective in this audience. Some people think that. Some people think it's all the model's fault. Some people think that it's the failure of Basel II. I had a word to say about that yesterday morning in the Q&A. Simply point out that Basel II hasn't yet been implemented. In the United States in particular, some people think that risk management has failed. And by that, we don't mean the function risk management, the chief risk officer and the people working for him or her. We mean the ability of the institution end-to-end to understand and manage and control successfully its risk. And personally, I believe that that is the case. So if this is true, where do we go from here? And that's the question that I'm really going to be addressing over the next over my time here. So just to begin, I think it's clear the crisis has exposed massive failures in risk management. We've got to start with the famous quote from Chuck Prince, the CEO of Citi, which was exquisitely badly timed in July of 2007. As long as the music's playing, you've got to get up and dance, and we're still dancing. Well, as everybody knows, he didn't get to dance for too much longer, and Citi is still dealing with the fallout from that particular party. There's a very important report from supervisors that what happened is that late 2007, early 2008, the supervisors of a dozen of the biggest financial institutions, banks and investment banks, got together and compared notes about what worked and what didn't, and issued an extraordinarily influential and important report called the Senior Supervisors Group Report. And you won't believe, it's impossible to read this report, 20 pages long, and not be astonished. And they're saying firms made strategic decisions to retain large exposures, talking here about CDOs and so on, that far exceeded their understanding of the risks. And then there's an Institute of International Finance report that I'll mention a little more later, which essentially nails it and says the key risks of these activities of these institutions were not identified. So what I want to do over the next few minutes is really focus in the beginning, what were the failures, what were the key lessons learned, and how do we address those? How do we move forward? How do we acknowledge those failures? What should we do differently? Then I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges in making risk management effective. And I think there's broad consensus about many of these challenges today. Say a few words about how firms should approach risk management now, And then literally in the last 24 hours, I've created an originally unplanned fourth section on the changes that are coming to the bank capital regime in Basel II, following on from some of the discussions yesterday. So everybody's got their favorite cause, you know, Alan Greenspan is the cause, and you know, regulators are the cause, and greed is the cause, and, you know, U.S. culture is the cause, and models are the cause. Well, the truth is there are multiple causes that all came together in the perfect storm to create this crisis. And what I've tried to do here is just group them together in three broad categories. Multiple structural flaws in regulation, risk management, and incentives. The regulatory failures were the massive arbitrage incentives built into the old Basel I, which much of the world is still running on today, where, for example, firms had huge incentives to securitize exposures and move them off balance sheet because they attracted relatively little capital when that was done. Obviously, there were some weaknesses in accounting policies and a general sort of laissez-faire, market knows best philosophy in some places. Very, you know, catastrophic failures, ineffective risk management practices we'll talk more about. And finally, incentives and behavior, conflicts of interest, moral hazard everywhere. The Federal Reserve will bail us out. Sadly, that's turned out to actually be true. Poor risk culture and lack of diligence in many of the activities and the rush for the pot of gold. We're going for gold. Hopefully there'll be a few nuggets of another kind here. Now, anybody who has any affiliation with McKinsey has an obligation at some point to put a slide up with a lot of information on it. So this is the one. What actually happened was, looking into this crisis and digging quite deeply with regulators and banks and investment banks around the world, we actually tried to write down all of the material contributing factors on one slide, and truly, it's a work of art. The good news is this presentation is on the website already, or will be shortly, so you won't be tested on this, but you can put your bifocals on and read it very carefully if you want to from the web. Essentially, just multiple, I think there are almost 40 bullet points here on this slide, so intended to suggest that, yes, indeed, many contributing factors. I want to highlight just a couple at the beginning to give you a sense of just how varied some of these weaknesses are. So the first one is at about 8:30. Business not aligned with the risk appetite and risk management competence of the firm. So what's true is that some of the firms that wound up at the wrong moment with the biggest positions and biggest exposures in these CDOs, these collateralized debt obligations, actually had no business plan to have any. It was not an approved strategy to pile up CDOs. It was just an extra 50 basis points. These things were AAA rated. Nobody thought too much about it. You know, million here, million there. Pretty soon you have 50 billion. If anybody had gone to the board and said, I think we're going to put 50 billion on our balance sheet, hey, what do you think? It's entirely possible that someone would have said, hang on, is that really a good idea? 50 billion of anything, T-bills, is risky. Let's talk about it. But that didn't happen in several high-profile examples. So this is a case where the business activity in the firm was outside the strategic plan for the business. The second bullet to highlight is at the bottom, excessive reliance on credit rating agencies and insufficient due diligence of your own. Hey, AAA is AAA, right? Well, we now know that AAA is not AAA. We all understand and feel comfortable with what it means to hold a AAA corporate bond. The AAA, i.e. 0.0001% probability of default on a collateralized debt obligation backed by mortgage-backed securities, meant something else altogether, and in particular depended upon some assumptions about correlation between house prices in different parts of the United States, which had been true for 80 years or 70 years, but no longer true in the crisis. Excuse me. Probably the most important failure to highlight here is now at 3:00, which is a lack of an integrated view of risk. Many of the biggest financial institutions that suffered the most in the crisis were not managing risk in an integrated fashion. This is very clear if you read that senior supervisors group report that I mentioned before. They were managing credit risk, and they had lots and lots of reports, reams of reports on credit risk. They had a market risk function. They were managing that. Somebody in Treasury was managing liquidity. They were managing risk in business divisions independently. The investment bank had a risk function, was managing its risk. The consumer lending business had a risk function. The securitization business was doing its thing. And it was actually impossible for those at the center and at the top, the CEO, the chief risk officer, and the executive committee and board, to actually put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together to get the complete picture of the risk profile and how it was changing. Now, most of the time, that's probably not a problem, because most of the time, the sky is blue, the sun is shining, and the sea is calm. The risk profile this quarter looks pretty much like the risk profile last quarter, which looked pretty much like the risk profile a year ago. When this crisis began to hit in early to mid-2007, the risk profile was actually changing very rapidly. And many of these firms could not and did not see that change. The fourth bullet to highlight is a little higher up on the right-hand side at about 2 o'clock. Insufficient liquidity risk management capabilities and practices. And why? Because frankly, the whole world was washing in liquidity for most of this decade. Yes, Alan Greenspan did keep rates at 1% for about 2 years, and there was, you know, billions if not trillions of dollars chasing incremental yield. So a liquidity shortage is frankly almost impossible for mortal human beings to think about how that could come to happen. As a result, liquidity was such a low priority that it barely got mentioned in Basel II, for example, when that was completed in 2004. The next point is at about 7:30 in the bottom left-hand corner. Risk concerns pushed aside. So in a number of institutions, the risk function, or what was left of it, actually did raise some concerns, did see things changing, and did actually take papers up to the CEO and the board. Hey, the risk profile's increasing. We need to reduce our risk. But sadly, looking at the sixth and final point I want to highlight here in the bottom left-hand corner, the business people to whom that appeal was made, in most cases, almost all cases, declined to reduce the risk profile for fear of disappointing market expectations around profit and earnings. There's a case explicitly described in that senior supervisors group report where there was a recommendation in April of 2007 to cut back the CDO position. The decision was made, no, we need the revenue for the next quarter's earnings. Let's revisit in August 2007. Well, by then there was no market for those securities. So, as you can see, many, many, many failures. I've just spoken briefly about six of them. So, what are the key lessons learned? One place to look is this report from these senior supervisors from the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Germany, Switzerland, and France, who got together and compared notes in credit risk. Who did what? What worked, what didn't? Market risk, what worked, what didn't? Liquidity risk management, counterparty risk management, and so on. And to try to summarize this extraordinarily important report from a year ago in one slide, here's the attempt. So on the left-hand side of this slide, you see the characteristics that these supervisors concluded were the characteristics they saw in the firms that did worst in the crisis. They were organized in silos. They aggressively expanded risk without clear guidance or boundaries. There was little capital market experience in the senior management of these firms. Skipping down to the third box, they had a very limited number of risk measures, incorporating which were built on historical assumptions that were outdated and inflexible. Some of these firms actually had to turn off their risk measurement in the crisis because it was just ridiculously wrong and misleading. And again, a limited integrated view across businesses. Lack of relevant internal valuation models for complex products and heavy reliance on external valuations. Get a spreadsheet from a price provider. That's fine as long as they can send you the spreadsheet. When there's no trading and there are no prices, they can't tell you anything. And if you have no internal way to value your positions, you're in trouble. So what did the supervisors see as the characteristics of the firms that did do well? On the management level, they saw a very rich dialogue at the top of the house amongst the senior management, the CEO, the CFO, the chief risk officer, the heads of the businesses, the treasury, and the control functions, all coming together at least weekly and in some instances, at some times during the crisis, daily. to talk about how fast things were moving and share information and make sure that the maximum information flow was coming into the key strategic decision makers. Very rapid escalation process. And I could say more, but I've got a lot of material to get through. I won't elaborate on that. But there's some telling examples of important bits of information being escalated up in some of the firms that did better. They saw a deliberate, explicit, transparent attempt to actually balance risk and return, rather than always it's all about revenue and profit is king. And they saw plenty of senior managers with prior experience in these complex businesses. On the modeling side further down, these firms had multiple tools drawing upon different underlying assumptions, and there was a flexibility, a nimbleness about these tools where the assumptions could be altered quickly when needed. Those tools gave a wide range of measures. And there was a deliberate, again, attempt to balance qualitative judgment and the result, the output of models. They saw a rigorous internal process to challenge valuations. If I'm lending a security in my repo business and it's being haircut by an additional 5 points, the market is telling me it's not worth par anymore. That information needs to go back up because we've got 50 billion of them and we're still marking them at 100 cents in the dollar. But the market's sending a signal it's no longer worth 100 cents in the dollar. So the ability to have consistent valuation processes through the firm, very important. So we would actually say that the qualities in the top right-hand corner of this slide constitute characteristics of what we would call a strong risk culture. And I think the supervisors conclude that the risk culture is the key determinant, the key driver of relative success through this crisis. So I want to talk a little bit now about the industry response. That was a regulatory document that I've attempted to summarize there. A lot in it, hard to do in one slide. The reference is on the bottom to the report. What did the industry do? There is a global banking industry association called the Institute of International Finance. It's Washington-based. Three of the big four Australian banks are members. And it constituted a committee in late 2007 of the firms that were really damaged and struggling to try internally as an industry body to try to figure out what went wrong. This is before that supervisor's report was released. This committee on market best practices actually met for about 9 months, had 65 member institutions, including McKinsey. I should say I was a member of this committee. And 6 working groups. It produced a report in July 2008 that analysed systematically the failures. So there were representatives from UBS, from Merrill Lynch, from Lehman Brothers, from all of the worst affected Citigroup, so on. A senior person, if not the president or CEO, from all the rating agencies were on that committee. And senior investors, like the chief investment officer from TIAA CREF, was on that committee. This committee produced some principles of conduct and specific best practice recommendations in 6 different areas, which are listed on the slide. Most importantly, for our purposes, risk management. And issued a report in July of 2008, which of course was immediately seized upon by regulators as the next potential checklist of best practices in all of these areas. To my knowledge, this is the first time there has been a global consensus about what constitutes best practice in risk management. So there are 6 areas, and I've got 6 slides here, but in the interest of time, I'm only going to talk about the risk management, the key risk management recommendations from this committee. So they were divided into several categories, and again, you can read this slide when you have more time from the paper on the web, but the first one, the very first recommendations in this report published last July were about the risk culture. The committee that produced this report, which included many chief risk officers, CEOs, CFOs, and the report was ultimately unanimously endorsed by the board of the Institute, declared that risk culture was the single most important driver. So specific recommendations that firms should develop a robust risk culture incorporated in the way the firm operates, covering all areas and activities. Accountability for risk management is for the whole institution, every employee, from the chairman of the board and the CEO right the way down. It isn't the role of the chief risk officer and the risk function. The first line of defense, so-called, the primary accountability for risk, actually is in the business line. There's a lot in this report about the role of the board and governance of risk. And there's a lot in this report about the way the risk function should be organized and the role of the chief risk officer. So the senior manager, particularly the CEO, is responsible for risk management, and the report talks in detail about the oversight role of the board. Let me talk just for a minute about the role of the chief risk officer. One of the two or three material developments following the publication of this report is that we're seeing the rapid rise to higher authority and stature of the chief risk officer role in biggest banks. Some of them didn't even have one before the crisis. All of them do now, and I think almost without exception, they all are senior veteran bankers with high stature and great respect, and they all report to the chief executive directly. It is no longer seen in these key firms as a staff function. So what did the... There's quite a lot in this report about the role of the chief risk officer. I travel around Asia a lot, spend time in China and elsewhere, and I often get asked the question, yeah, we've got one, yeah, but what does he do? What's he supposed to do? So what is the chief risk officer supposed to do? First of all, the firm should ensure that whoever that person is, he or she can influence the key decision makers within the firm. It's no good having someone in the cubicle producing a spreadsheet that nobody will listen to on anything important. The chief risk officer should have the mandate to ascertain that the firm's overall risk level is consistent with its risk appetite. The chief risk officer should provide a thoughtful, integrated view of overall risk. That's hard. And support the senior management of the firm by identifying, putting special focus on new and emerging risks and concentrations. A comprehensive perspective is needed. In many cases, the chief, you know, there's a chief credit officer doing credit and the chief risk officer does, you know, everything else or some other things. No, a comprehensive perspective is required. The chief risk officer should define and articulate the appetite for risk. Where is the boundary? How much is too much? And ensure that that risk appetite boundary is adopted throughout the firm. The chief risk officer should be accountable for ensuring consistency between the risk appetite on the one hand and the strategy. It's fine to say our risk appetite is some embellishment or elaboration of low risk, but if we're then going to give targets to all the businesses to grow 20% per year, there's a disconnect between the risk appetite and the performance plans and the strategy of the firm. The risk management function should take an integrated approach to capturing all sources of risk, including notably those risks that are off balance sheet, and also understand and take into account and educate the organization about the technical limitations of models, such as value at risk. Now, the committee made some recommendations for the official sector. Some of those are already in the process of being implemented. In the interest of time, the recommendations on compensation, there's a heck of a lot of work happening in the industry to redesign and realign compensation. In particular, the second one there, incentives, bonuses. Incentive schemes should not induce risk-taking in excess of the firm's risk appetite. Liquidity, valuation, credit underwriting ratings, investor due diligence, transparency and disclosure in two categories. Transparency of structured products and securities and transparency of the firm's risk profile. Okay, let me move on. I just want to say a few words about some of the key challenges for risk management. Why is it that risk management is so hard? Why did it fail? What's hard about it? Surely it should be pretty simple. So, fundamentally, the risk function in the firm, and more generally the leadership, the CEO, the heads of the businesses, face three challenges to manage risk. What are they? The first one is they have to see how the external environment is changing and perceive and understand what are the drivers of those changes. So, for example, in the case of the crisis, the softening of U.S. house prices, U.S. house price declines ultimately, and the rapid diminishing of market liquidity. You have to actually have your eyes open and see what's happening. Second challenge, so obviously that's pretty easy if you're in the United States, but if you're in Japan or you're in Europe and you're holding CDOs, you don't have a mortgage operation. A bit harder for you to see. The second challenge, which is perhaps bigger, is to understand the impact of these changes and potential impacts going forward of what you're seeing across all of your businesses and portfolios and geographies. So, again, in the crisis, obviously if we see house prices going down, it's pretty clear if we have a residential mortgage business, there's going to be an impact there. Less clear an impact on our securitization business. Less clear an impact on our commercial lending activity. Less clear an impact on our trading business, where we're trading credit default swaps and CDOs and so on. Less clear an impact on our liquidity risk profile, and much less clear the impact on our exposures in Asia or Australia. So it's very challenging to take an integrated view across the firm, all geographies, all businesses, all portfolios. But the hardest challenge, it's very hard to understand the risk profile. It's opaque. It changes rapidly. I've spent my entire professional life in that pursuit in a number of different firms. It's very challenging even from the inside. What's more challenging when the risk profile changes is to act. It's tempting. Risk is risk, right? And it's tempting to say, oh, another 3 months, another 6 months, then we'll act. What you need to do is you need to act now. You need to trim the sail while the sky is still blue. And if you don't, you're in trouble. And that is extremely difficult. That becomes a cultural issue. All three of these are challenging in practice. And if you read the Senior Supervisors Group report, you'll see that of the 11 institutions covered, there are examples of institutions that fell at each of those hurdles. So I've already said the aggregate integrated risk profile is opaque. Fundamentally opaque to insiders as well as outsiders, and very challenging for firms to properly understand. Now, if you think about that, if you believe that statement, then there's some very, very fundamental implications for society in how much risk firms should be allowed to take, given that ultimately the taxpayer is on the hook for the bailout and the damage that we're seeing done to our economies. Note, statistical tables have only limited utility. It's for a decade or more, there have been efforts to improve disclosure of risk of firms. Basel Pillar 3, for example, which has been in place now in Australia for about 6 months from late last year. November were the first disclosures. Very helpful, but not completely helpful to fully understand the risk profile. I know. There's great difference between those disclosures and what might be in a board risk management report to a risk committee. What you really need is English explanations of what the biggest risks are and what's driving those changes in the risk profile and what are the options, what can we do about it. So 100 pages of statistical data, frankly, is in many cases almost useless. So we talked a little bit about culture. I'll quickly fly through this in the interest of time. In the view of many, in particular that industry committee, culture is the single most important determinant of risk management effectiveness. To understand this, I want to tell you that if you ever talk to anyone who's been a chief risk officer or a CEO or a CFO or the head of a business or in a senior risk role, they'll tell you. For the larger, more complex firms, it is completely impossible to know everything that you need to know about the emerging risks and the rapid changes to the risk profile through the formal channels, the reports that get generated once a month or once a quarter and eventually get sanitized multiple times and come up to you. If you are entirely reliant on the formal channels, you are essentially blind, especially when things are moving very quickly. Therefore, effective informal channels of information are essential. So, if firms are going to balance risk and return at every level, if that's the intention and that's a characteristic of a strong risk culture, then they need to deliberately and consciously create an environment that encourages and values dialogue about risk. Firms need to make it safe for employees, particularly young employees, to question and challenge things that don't look right.
30 minutes.
Thank you. And to escalate the things that they don't understand, and then actually reward that behavior. In particular, sometimes we say, It's essential to ensure that bad news travels upwards quickly. But let me tell you, it's extremely difficult to do. Difficult to do in Australia, difficult to do in the US. No one likes to bring bad news. Difficult to do in China, difficult to do everywhere. But we have to make this a priority. Okay, I've listed here a few common impediments to effective risk management. I'll fly through these. The first is limiting the resourcing and the influence of the risk management function. Just contain it to measurement reporting, then it won't get in the way of any revenue generation. Don't involve it in anything high level, the operational planning or strategic business decisions. Many firms really don't want to define their risk appetite in advance because there's a sense that it's sort of limiting options somehow. Every half we have to make our targets, and we're usually pretty resourceful about doing that. Don't tie me down in advance. Don't constrain me. And in some firms, risk management concerns have been raised and literally given the back of the hand and pushed aside. I'm personally aware of 3 chief risk officers of top 20 institutions globally who resigned because they didn't feel they could get a fair hearing. Personal incentives are important. What I'm really saying on this slide here is that business people with 20, 30 years experience do understand, actually, that tail events, unlikely things do happen. But mostly they think they're only going to be in their job for 3, 4, 5 years, and the likelihood of it happening on my watch is very low. Therefore, I'm pretty much incentivized not to pay too much attention. I'm not going to change my whole profile and strategy to avoid a tail event when, frankly, I've got my fingers crossed. Yeah, it may happen later, but then it's somebody else's problem. So again, the answer here is incentives and risk culture that we talked about before. Let's quickly fly through this section. I want to get to the regulatory piece, just say a few words about that. So look, given the catastrophic risk management failures that we've seen, it's essential to have a robust integrated risk management framework. Here is one such. I saw a couple of others yesterday in some of the breakout sessions, and they're good, right? The real question is how to make these work. So this framework says insight and risk transparency are at the heart of effective risk management. You really need to understand, do you or don't you have insight into the risks that matter most to your business? Are you the natural owner of these risks? And in some cases, really no. Some of the banks that piled up these CDOs based on American subprime mortgages were very, very, very far away from the United States and really had no knowledge of how these things perform. The way you make decisions in your organization, are those processes robust? Is there proper governance and organization? And finally, culture. Does your culture reinforce risk management principles? Not just in a crisis now, but when the sky is blue and the sun is shining and the sea is calm. What formal and informal mechanisms support the right mindsets and behaviors? What do we say that banks need to do now? First of all, fix the fundamentals. Many of the failures were extremely basic. We didn't know we had 50 billion CDOs. That's pretty basic. That's not a PhD modeling problem. That's we don't know what we're doing problem. Pretty basic. So, transparency. I've got a list of things here and time is against me, so I can't go through them all. But please take a look at this. Ensure you have full transparency into the important risks and work hard to develop this integrated view of risk across all your business. Redesign your risk reporting. I've probably seen the risk reports in 30 or 40 major banks, and I'd say 3/4 of them, pretty useless to understand the risk. Urgent work needed there. Stress testing is the really going to come into its prime now. You're seeing what's happening in the United States right now. Do firms have the ability to comprehensively stress test all their businesses and their revenues under a variety of economic scenarios? Most banks, frankly, don't. That's an urgent capability that needs to be developed. Focus on what's changing, new, or growing rapidly. And write descriptive analysis, not telephone books of numbers. I think I'll just move on. Once you fix the basics in each of those categories, it's critical then to go beyond the fundamentals to increase resilience. Improve your understanding on systemic and emerging issues and risks. Make all the unstated assumptions in your analysis and your models explicit. If it's too complex, if you don't understand it, don't own it. Don't grow more than your risk appetite and capabilities allow. Embed risk thinking in your strategic planning and budgeting. Think in advance about what are the risk implications of your performance targets. You want to grow 20%? How are you going to do that? New customers, new products, new geographies, subprime. What is it? How are you going to meet that target? What are those risk implications? Are we comfortable with those? And further build the culture. So the CEO priorities, ensure sufficient capital and liquidity while the storm is raging. That's the key to survival. Review and reduce your portfolio risks as needed and improve your the transparency of your risk profile. This third point there is the hardest to do. You think it's hard to raise capital? It's incredibly hard in a short period of time to make the risk profile more transparent. Make steady progress on the fundamentals and then go beyond to increase your resiliency for the next crisis. We don't know what it'll be, but we know it's going to come. Finally, when you get to that point, if you're fortunate enough to be well positioned, look for opportunities to realign and optimize your business model under the new regulatory capital regime. I'll talk about it now. Buy attractively valued assets if you have the capital and liquidity, and cherry pick the talent. There's plenty of that out there now. Just quickly, I think I've got 5 minutes left.
Three.
Sorry, three?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Right, well, we're done. No, let me just say a couple of things. 30 seconds a slide. It's important to understand the industry is reacting in a very significant, substantial way to learn the lessons and change the way risk is managed. The regulators are doing the same thing, and you're seeing a lot of that through G20. What this slide does is it just is a short list of some of the more important papers and documents that are guiding the regulatory policy response. I was going to mention a couple. I won't, because I've only got 2.5 minutes left. But clearly the emerging directions of the regulatory change, which is now going to be global, which is a great thing, were recently spelled out by the Financial Stability Forum, now to be called going forward the Financial Stability Board. Strengthen the regulatory capital framework so the quality and level of capital in the banking system increases. Revise the market risk framework of Basel II to reduce the reliance on VaR-based VaR-based capital estimates. Supplement the risk-based capital requirement with a simple non-risk-based measure to contain leverage. Use the Basel Committee's published late last year some very prescriptive requirements around stress testing practices as a critical part of bank supervision. So stress testing is coming to all banks, and in particular to a bank near you, and make appropriate adjustments to dampen excessive cyclicality of minimum capital. So there's 3 or 4 slides here. I won't go through them in detail. Okay, I'll skip that. The first one just summarizes some of the major changes to capital ratios, risk-weighted assets, and capital composition. So there is very broad support for a leverage ratio. It's already been implemented in 3 different countries, as you can see on the slide. Sadly, it's a different leverage ratio that's been cap on leverage that's been implemented in those 3 countries. But I think we'll converge later. We just want to get the leverage controlled. A lot of discussion about how to mitigate pro-cyclicality using through-the-cycle estimates of probability of default. No time to talk about that. This slide is very important. The Basel Committee is revising the market risk framework very substantially, and the end result of the changes listed on this slide is that the capital that banks will have to hold against trading activities and proprietary trading activities will increase by a multiple of between 3 and 10. So they're introducing, everybody knows what VaR is, you're introducing a new thing called stressed VaR, calculating that every day, and instead of taking the maximum of VaR and stressed VaR and using that for capital, we're actually driving the capital off the sum of the two. No logic there, just get a bigger capital number. And then we're introducing, telling the truth, right? We're introducing a new capital charge for credit downgrade risk. There's already a capital charge for credit default risk. We're introducing a new one for downgrade risk, and that's frankly where the tens of billions were lost in the recent crisis. Shut the gate, the horse has bolted. Bottom line, capital for trading will increase by a factor of at least 3, and as much as 10 if you're trading a lot of credit risky things. Okay, what does that mean? That means trading, prop trading will be uneconomical and forced out of the banking system. Changes to securitization, more capital, how should banks respond? I'm done.